We just finished opening weekend of the NFL. There are actually a pair of Monday night games tonight to round out the action. There's always plenty to talk about pro football, even if you pay no attention whatsoever to the scores and stats. Because the NFL is the country's most popular sports league, a huge economic and social force, and consequently also the focus of controversy. Two quick examples, brain damage and kneeling during the anthem. These and more are the focus of the new book, Big Game, The NFL in Dangerous Times. It is the work of Mark Leibovich, the chief national correspondent for the New York Times Magazine, based in Washington. He is the author of three other books and an admitted fan of the New England Patriots. Very much a welcome to Mark Leibovich. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. It's good to be with you. And whoever just heard that thing about the New England Patriots, I'm not one of the bad ones. You can buy the book anyway. I try to be good.
I have to explain the same thing. I went to high school in Connecticut, and my high school teams were called the Patriots, so I have no choice, really.
Oh. Okay, yeah, you have the disease.
I do. Yeah. Anyway, we share it. So, Mark, are you lucky or good? I mean, the NFL was not nearly as controversial as it is now when you got started on this project.
Yeah, no, I don't know. I think certainly it's been an eventful few years. I mean, the irony, as you kind of pointed out before, was my life is politics. I mean, I cover this stuff for a living. I've been sort of chronicling the swamp of Washington for the last 15 years or so. And I thought I would, you know, get a little break here, but it turned out just the swamp of the NFL is its own kind of swamp. And I was amazed at how deeply I was able to dive into it, but also how inescapable politics are, certainly in this moment, but that was true even before Donald Trump came along. So, it was quite an excursion. I'm back to my day job now, but football, I mean, there's always something. I mean, the reality show just is nonstop, and it's not unlike a certain president we're all trying to keep up with.
So what did you set out to do here, and did the mission change as the research went on?
Yeah, it did change. I mean, originally I did a profile for the Times Magazine on Tom Brady in 2014, so it was something of a labor of love, and I got a chance to spend a fair amount of time with him, and I got very interested in football. I mean, I'm a fan anyway, but this was actually a peek behind the curtain of a world I just didn't realize was as fascinating and that just existed to the level it did. And after the Brady story, I sort of thought that, you know, maybe there was a whole book to be done on him, because I think, you know, he's an amazing player and an amazing story. After, you know, about 6 months sort of kicking around there, it was clear to me that the rest of the league was the story. I mean, there were so many great stories to tell. There was so much going on and so many problems. I mean, I'd never been around an institution that was so commingling of just precariousness but also prosperity. I mean, they're just printing money, and yet there's a sense around the NFL, especially among the owners and the people who run it out of New York, that the chandelier's about to fall on everyone's heads. And it's just a very nervous time, and I thought it was pretty fascinating to chronicle that.
What's the major source of the trepidation about the sense of chandelier falling?
I think a couple of things. I mean, one is obviously health and safety. I mean, the rates of participation among young people in football are just going pretty sharply down. I mean, that's true of all sports, really, but football, I mean, you know, quite markedly so, just because it is such a dominant national pastime. I mean, it's been the dominant professional sport in this country for 50, 60 years. And so, I mean, there's just, you know, you have fewer people playing. TV ratings have gone down a couple, pretty decisively over the last couple of years. But also, there's a sense that, look, the world is getting more global, whether people want to admit that or not. I mean, it's just people are looking to, you know, they're paying more attention to soccer leagues around the world. Basketball is a more global sport, and football is a quintessentially American sport, and it's unclear sort of where they can expand into other than maybe Mexico City or Europe or parts of Europe like England or something. And look, I mean, they've become so accustomed to this explosive growth for so long, it's only a matter of time before the rest of the culture catches up, and the politics that we've seen both on the left and on the right have not necessarily been friendly to football. So I think in some ways the unifying force that used to be the National Football League has become just, you know, it's become as divisive as many other institutions in this country.
Is it becoming a love-hate relationship for some fans? I know that we talked to the author of Quitting Football. I forget the name of the title, but he had enough of football, and I wondered about that attitude, whether it was prevalent. I've had enough versus, but I love my team.
Yeah, I mean, there is a lot of that. It's not unlike, you know, I hate Congress, but I love my member of Congress, so I'm going to vote for him or her again. I mean, it's not unlike that. I mean, I do think that that we have a real love-hate relationship. I mean, a love for football and kind of a hate for the National Football League. I mean, there are many markets in the country where Roger Goodell should not be going without, you know, added security. I mean, whether it's areas that have lost their team, areas that have been, you know, have been sort of bilked out of stadiums or had to pay for stadiums that they don't want, or places that, you know, the people perceive the commissioner and the league office to have botched disciplinary things, whether it's Baltimore or Dallas or New England over the Deflategate fiasco of a few years ago. So, I mean, a lot of people just resent the heck out of this league, and yet they pay big prices to sort of either go to the games or watch on TV and, you know, for these premium packages and so forth. And, you know, the league goes right on humming. So I don't think it's going to die anytime soon, and I'm not one of these sort of boycott people who thinks that, like, I'm just going to turn off the TV because I have such objections. But I do think that there are a lot of warning signs.
Indeed. And in fact, Steve Almond was the other guest we talked to a while back about his book, Against Football.
I want to read that. That's actually, I've heard it's pretty good.
It is pretty good. So Mark Leibovich is our guest today. He's talking about his book, Big Game, the NFL in Dangerous Times. We'll come back and talk about some of the issues facing the NFL, from health and safety of players to the political stuff, including kneeling during the anthem, which is still unresolved in the NFL. We'll come back and talk more with Mark and take phone calls and emails from you when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking about pro football on the opening weekend of pro football. Two more games tonight to round out the first weekend of the NFL. Mark Leibovich goes a bit deeper than just scores and stats and talks about some of the issues facing the league. There's a tattered logo of the NFL on the just cover of the book. It's called Big Game, the NFL in Dangerous Times. You can join the conversation on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We've already mentioned politics, the swamp of Washington that you usually cover, the swamp of the NFL that you moved to cover for the book. But so let's talk about the crossovers of the politics-NFL tie. We did mention Donald Trump already and his dislike of the kneeling of players during the anthem. Donald Trump in the league, though, has a long sort of relationship. Is this something that this is a club he always wanted to belong to, from the way you write it?
Very, very much so. Yeah, no, he's been trying to get an NFL team for about, you know, off and on for about four decades. I mean, it started with him being the owner of the USFL's New Jersey Generals, and his whole plan and being sort of the major domo of the USFL was to force the NFL to want to merge with him and the new upstart league. That never happened. And over the years, he's tried to make purchases of various teams, including my New England Patriots, and then most recently the Buffalo Bills in 2014. And the consolation prize, of course, is that he gets to be in the White House heckling, right? So, no, but like a lot of things with our president, this one is sort of driven in some ways or animated in some ways by some personal history or personal animosity that, you know, I think is obviously a subtext to all of this.
And you do see some clear parallels between the league and the president in ability to generate attention.
No question. I mean, these are probably, I mean, politics or, you know, national politics and NFL football have been sort of two of the most potent reality shows we've had going for the last decade or so, or a couple of decades or so. And Donald Trump just sort of amped that whole thing up. And in a sense, it was almost inevitable that the two could collide, because there's only so much room in the American culture for these American culture, American carnage reality shows. And, you know, the NFL has the added bonus of being just this great spectacle of American life, and Donald Trump gets to be right in the middle of it again.
You know, the NFL doesn't always like the attention, like with Deflategate, which, by the way, as a Patriots fan, one guy in the newsroom knows he can get the veins in my head to pop out on my forehead by calling Tom Brady a cheater. Yeah, yeah. But it certainly
they
gets...
They do it all the time, by the way. Very, very, very easy fodder for the trolls.
Absolutely.
And they're everywhere. I'd probably hate us, too.
Probably. It's like, you know, it's like understand... Well, certainly as a New England fan, you can understand what it's like to hate the Yankees.
Oh, yeah. And no, yes, no question. No, I fully understand. Look, I guess I welcome it, but it's also Absolutely understandable. So I try to be a good example.
Okay. So anyway, it gets more serious than the underinflated footballs when we get into the realm of player health. We just talked about this, and it is causing a drop in people interested in playing the game. You've talked to many owners and execs. I mean, what do they say about what happens to players' brains and other health issues?
Well, I mean, they all have a pretty pretty go-to sort of line, which is the game has never been safer. We're pouring millions of dollars into research and, you know, trying to make things safer. And the fact is, I mean, no one is going to come right out and say, this game is totally safe. I mean, they're all very lawyered up on this thing. I mean, they are so terrified of some new regulation or some kind of lawsuit that's going to be the thing that kills the golden goose. So they sort of talk in a lot in their same sound bites, and they try to defer a lot of their lot of their rhetoric on this to Dr. Goodell, who talks in the same stiff and scripted way on this stuff than you would as we've all seen from so many podiums. But the fact is, look, football is unsafe at any speed. They can make some they can maybe make a small difference at the margins with equipment innovations or rule changes, something like that. But ultimately, people just keep getting bigger, stronger, faster, and this is a dangerous game, and that just doesn't change, and it won't change. So, the owners are pretty tongue-tied, but sometimes they can't help themselves, and then, you know, they'll say goofy things, and Goodell can't help himself, and he'll say goofy things. Like a few years ago at a Super Bowl press conference, he compared the risk of playing football to the risk of sitting on the couch, and he was roundly and, I think, properly ridiculed for that. But, look, they don't have any good answers. I mean, it's just, look, they essentially operate like a drug lord, and they are serving a nation of football junkies, and the relationship is pretty dependent after a while.
Mark Leibovich is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, chief national correspondent for the New York Times Magazine. He's written a book about the NFL called Big Game, the NFL in Dangerous Times. So let's talk a little more about Roger Goodell, the NFL commissioner, and I'm curious about some disconnects here in how his role is viewed. First of all, how do the owners view the job of the commissioner?
Well, look, I mean, pretty narrowly and pretty parochially. I mean, it's basically to make them more money. I mean, Roger Goodell has sort of a twofold job, and one is just to make billionaires billions of dollars more, and he's very good at that. I mean, the NFL has incredible leverage. I mean, it's 77 of the top 100 rated TV shows in the United States last year were football games, NFL games. So, everyone wants a piece of them, and that's why they can sell their broadcast rights for billions and billions of dollars to any number of networks. So they're in a very, very strong and monopolistic position. And Roger Goodell has proved very good at, like, sort of using that leverage. But what he's also very good at is he's the son of a politician, and he is himself a politician whose by far most important constituency is the 32 owners who hire him. And he has this call sheet on his desk that basically tells him the last time he talked to the owner of the Carolina Panthers, David Tepper, or, you know, the Miami Dolphins, Stephen Ross, whoever. And if 2 weeks have passed, he will call to make sure that they have what they need, to, like, listen to them, make sure they're not wanting for anything, make sure they know that he's thinking of him. And it's very akin to a politician sort of buttering up his donors. And, he is rewarded for making them feel included by they keep reelecting him every 4 or 5 years, and he just signed a new 5-year contract that could pay him up to $200 million. So, he's happy, and his bosses are happy, and even though secretly they'll say, wow, this guy's really unpopular, and why do we always have these fiascos? But essentially their bottom line is not what you would not anything that would surprise anyone.
All right, so as long as they're making money, they're okay with him. Sure. Now, do the players have any notion that Roger Goodell is there for them in any form?
Yeah, I don't think so. I mean, I think there have been so many instances in which, you know, trust has been breached or just broken. And look, it's clear that Roger Goodell, he will say, I represent football. I'm looking after the interests of the fans, of the players, the referees. It's clear he's interested in the owners. The owners are, that's where his bread is buttered, and he knows that as well as anyone. And I think the players know it too.
So while we're speaking of non-breezy personalities, you do refer to Roger Goodell as the enemy of lightness in any form. So let's stay in that vein and talk about Bill Belichick, the head coach of the New England Patriots.
Yes.
Is he that
yes.
dark?
Well, apparently he has a lighter side, or at least a very animated side, where he can, you know, if you ask the right question in his weekly press conference, he will favor you with a 25-minute speech on the history of the drop kick, or, you know, something just goofy. I mean, look, I think I see what most people see, which is just how he interacts, you know, in public, and he doesn't really give much of himself. So apparently there's a different Bill Belichick in private, but I've never been favored with it. I got to spend much more time with Robert Kraft, the owner of the Patriots, and Brady himself, so that was cool. But I don't particularly like Bill Belichick's act. I think it's tiresome as a consumer to have to watch, and a lot of the other coaches I met and got to talk to a little bit were far more compelling. But look, I mean, it's obviously been very successful for him, and it's to the benefit of the team I root for, so I'm not going to complain.
Is there, you mentioned Robert Kraft, the owner of the Patriots. Is there something he does that other owners don't besides employing Bill Belichick and Tom Brady?
Well, I think that's the beginning. I mean, he's a politician like the rest of them, but he's probably, I mean, it helps you immensely to, in that world, to win. And when you win, you have a cachet. You know, maybe people shoot for you. Maybe you are the victim of other people's jealousy and envy. That's what he would say. And maybe it also makes you arrogant and unlikable, which I think can be somewhat guilty of also. I mean, I don't think he's a terribly good politician. I think his act is, you know, I think like a lot of kind of entitled and pleased with themselves billionaires, it's just not the most likable act in the world. And I saw that up close, which is not to say he's not interesting and fun to talk to, and not to say we didn't connect on on several levels. I mean, you know, for one, I root for the team that he owns. But look, I mean, I think one of the great takeaways for me in this book, and I hope this will be true for readers, The power of NFL owners is one of the great underreported stories of sports in this culture in this moment, just because these are, you know, legitimate entertainment magnates in, you know, 30, 32 markets across the country. And they have such incredible power. Very little is known about them. And frankly, I mean, based on my dealings, I was pretty underwhelmed.
We're talking to Mark Leibovich, the chief national correspondent for the New York Times Magazine, about his book, Big Game, the NFL in Dangerous Times. You can join the conversation on the exchange. Your thoughts about pro football and the future that lies ahead of it when it's dealing with things like players' health and players kneeling during the national anthem, all the other issues that swirl around the NFL all the time. 800-838-3760 to join the conversation by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. It's sort of obliquely about the Patriots, but there was a lot of stuff said in this last offseason about the joyless nature of the Patriots, which made me wonder, wouldn't just about anybody in the game give up at least a little bit of joy for a lot more winning?
Yeah, I mean, you would think. I think that's been proven true over the years. I mean, a lot of players have sort of gone up there towards the end of their careers, maybe taken less money for the right to you know, be in contention for the Super Bowl every year. Having said that, I mean, it doesn't look like a lot of... I mean, look, it's not like Bill Belichick is asking me to come try out for the team either. I mean, I don't think he needs a 53-year-old reporter, you know, trying out for the team. But I do think that... you know, I think a lot of this started after the Super Bowl when some members of the Eagles, particularly Lane Johnson, an offensive lineman, said that the Patriot way is a joyless environment and, you know, they play without joy. And I think that rang true. I mean, it doesn't look like a terrible, I mean, it looks like a very serious and obviously very successful place to play football, and it's not for everyone, but they've gotten results. But it also doesn't, if you're looking to have absolute fun and joy and lightness in your work environment, that's probably not the place for you. I asked Tom Brady's dad, Tom Sr., who lives in the Bay Area, a lovely guy, what he thought of this, and he said, well, they don't play with joy, but find me any really, really sustained, successful organization anywhere that is able to succeed when there's joy. And that was sort of an interesting line, but he didn't question the premise of this at all. So, look, I mean, no one's asking me to try out, but it probably wouldn't be the first place I would want to play, but it's a place to go to win.
Tom Brady Sr. sounds like he was really very receptive to you and not nearly as hard to get a hold of as Tom Brady Jr.
Yeah, Tom Brady, I mean, look, I mean, Tom Jr. was actually fairly receptive just by email. I mean, he's very busy, but he's a very friendly, kind of approachable guy once you sort of breach the initial, initial wall. But you're right. I mean, Tom Sr., who sells insurance policies in the Bay Area, lives in the same house that he raised his four kids in, lovely guy and just very accessible, just very warm and extremely undiplomatic in ways that his son obviously can't be. So I sort of appreciated the id to the superego that Tom Jr. has to put up.
Let me come back to the issue of player health and the idea of winning but without joy. I mean, and Tom Senior sounds like he summed it up pretty well, that any sustained organization doesn't necessarily have a whole lot of joy around it. But
right.
But the idea, though, about things like players' health, you know, I mean, the owners, it seems like, are more than willing to say, oh, well, you know, we're going to get a few bones broken, and we're going to get a few concussions on the way to being successful. Do the players buy into that in the same way?
Oh, I think largely, yeah. I mean, I think the people know what they're getting into at this point. I mean, I don't think there's a lack of information out there. And what's interesting is you hear again and again, I mean, you talk to players, you know, former players who have had all kinds of physical problems, you know, including cognitive and you know, neurological problems. And you read all these stories about how horrible their lives are and how much pain they're in and how they can't remember anything. And then you'll ask them at the end of these conversations, you know, would you do it again? And they say, absolutely. So, I mean, I think it's at a certain point, there is a buyer beware thing that I don't know if people can take comfort from it, but it is a decision that people are willing to make. And it is a trade-off, I guess, that people are willing to make, as perverse as it might sound to some people.
We were talking at home yesterday about the NFL coming a little late to the party. College football had been around for a few decades by the time the NFL came around. And is there any concern among the folks in the NFL that they could be eclipsed in popularity by college football? There are so many more teams to cheer for, certainly.
Yeah, I mean, this has been true for years. I mean, there has been that tension. I mean, there's always been that sort of uneasy detente between college football and pro football, in which, you know, I guess the NFL agrees not to have Saturday games, and the college agrees, you know, not to have Sunday games, or, you know, they try to, I guess, sort of sort out the spoils of when they can schedule their games. But no, I don't think so. And I also don't think the NCAA is really the standard bearer of virtue and responsible, organizational behavior either. So, I mean, they have their own problems. And look, it's the same game, too. I mean, the same physical risks exist. And I think, you know, they have some issues, too, let's put it that way. So I think the moral high ground people might be seeking if they were to leave the NFL probably doesn't rest in the NCAA either.
Mark, how extensive is the ecosystem in which the NFL operates? I mean, we've got lots of people who never touch a football who depend upon a viable NFL for their livelihoods, it seems.
Right. Yeah. No, it's true. I mean, there's, like, it's a multi-billion-dollar industry. I mean, the, entire communities do depend on it. And if you don't, you know, believe me, just, like, just look at the void that it can leave in communities like St. Louis or even now, you know, Oakland, San Diego, and, you know, in the periods where, like, Cleveland was without a team or Baltimore was without a team. And, so huge amounts of livelihood, whether stadium workers or just, you know, people in the local economy, but also just the civic, togetherness. And I think all the things that make pro sports, you know, very positive in some communities. I mean, I remember last year during the playoffs, I remember going to Minnesota for the Super Bowl, and the Vikings just a few weeks earlier had won this just thrilling playoff game against the Saints in the wild card round, and they got clobbered the week later by the Eagles. But just the euphoria it set off, that game that everyone was talking about all over the country for a few days. I mean, you could see it was still contagious. And there are very, very few things in life that bring communities together and give, you know, people these spasms of joy that can do that. So I think that's powerful, but I also think that certainly there's an economic component to it.
Which I always wonder how these economic decisions get made, though. I mean, we went from Los Angeles, as you mentioned, getting the benefits of St. Louis losing the Rams again,
right?
Losing them back to Los Angeles. But so Los Angeles went from no NFL team for like a decade and a half to two teams practically overnight.
Yeah, and it didn't seem like L.A. was suffering that much. I don't believe for a second that they need two teams now. I mean, I think the Chargers should be in San Diego, and I think it's ridiculous that they're not. But having said all that, yeah, I mean, L.A. is actually one of those, it's a unique city in that there is so much entertainment there. There is so much to do. It is so big. It is so vast that it probably might rely less on a singular, NFL team than other cities do. But you're right. I mean, it is a zero-sum game, and places, the franchise relocation like that is a really dirty business, and that's one of the many sausage factories I got a chance to look into.
All right, we'll talk more about the rest of the sausage factory and the big game, or Big Game is the name of the book, The NFL in Dangerous Times. Mark Leibovich, its author, our guest. We'll come back to the Jefferson Exchange. Take your phone calls. Talk about Colin Kaepernick in a minute 10. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking about the National Football League and its ups and downs, and certainly its moment in the sun and the spotlight and under the microscope all at once here in our time. The book by Mark Leibovich, the chief national correspondent for the New York Times Magazine, is called Big Game, The NFL in Dangerous Times. You can join the conversation on the Exchange, 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. You talked about the NFL owners, and of course there are 32 teams as billionaires. Is that pretty much de facto? It's right down the line. They're all worth billions.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, Mark Davis, the owner of the then Oakland Raiders, was probably under $1 billion. I mean, I think he would have said he had like half a billion. But then the city of Las Vegas decided to build him a stadium, and the worth of the Oakland Raiders is now well over $1 billion, and so Mark Davis is fine too. So yes, these are all billionaires. So everyone can rest easy.
So how much public money is going into the Las Vegas stadium, for example, and why does that seem to keep happening when cities have needs other than to have NFL teams?
Yeah, I mean, especially Las Vegas. I mean, it is stunning. I mean, probably about, it could be up to $1 billion. I mean, between $750 million for the stadium, and then when you throw in, road improvements and other infrastructure things, I mean, it could easily top $1 billion. So, yeah, I don't know. I mean, there are cities like San Diego that absolutely refuse to, let their taxpayers, pay for a new stadium, and I think rightly. And Dean Spanos, the owner of the Chargers, said, okay, goodbye, we're going to L.A. And no one really thought he was going to do this. They thought it was sort of a bluff, and that includes many of his business partners, but he did it anyway. So now L.A. has two teams, and I still haven't met many Los Angeles Charger fans. I have people in L.A. who have said the same. So, but anyway, yeah, they're playing football every Sunday in Carson and soon in Inglewood when the Rams' beautiful stadium opens up in a couple of years. So, now they have two, and I think San Diego is another market really ticked off of the league.
Let's talk about the Colin Kaepernick situation generally. This is the backup quarterback for the 49ers, had been a starter, took him to the Super Bowl a few years before that, decided to protest by kneeling on the sidelines, police brutality against African-Americans by kneeling during the national anthem. How did he come up with that form of protest, that method?
I don't know. I mean, I would have loved to have talked to Colin Kaepernick. I tried a bunch of times, but he wasn't available. I think he's writing his own book. But look, I don't know. I mean, obviously, it's something he feels strongly about, and I think, I don't know what his intent was truly, but I mean, I think it clearly has been effective in bringing awareness to the issue, and certainly, has really changed the face of activism in sports these days, and I think has, had a huge impact on the National Football League. So, Colin Kaepernick is obviously the most famous backup quarterback in history. I think the interesting thing will be to see how his story unfolds and how it goes forward.
Particularly with the new wrinkles in the issue, which we'll get to in a second. First, I want to take a call from Jay in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Mark Leibovich, the author of Big Game. Hi, Jay. Jay, you there? Go ahead.
Yeah. Hello.
Hi, go ahead.
Can you hear me?
Mm-hmm.
Hi, Jay. Yep.
Yeah. Hello. I thought that Colin Kaepernick had and still has a great message, but his trouble is he was unable to articulate it clearly and he handled its delivery so poorly that his message got lost. And I'm a 60-year-old white guy, and I didn't hear his message actually until Trump started to put in a patriotism message. But I think the time has finally come for the NFL to come up with a way to actually articulate it for him. And if I were them, I would designate one player per game that would kneel on purpose at each game, but make it so that the message of Colin Kaepernick is stated each time about racial bias and what is actually going on, so that it doesn't get caught up in patriotism and all the other drama about it. And then I would also get him back on a player's roster. I would get this thing behind them and move forward as quickly as possible while recognizing and acknowledging the very message that he is saying, and which is about racial bias. And I thank you for taking my call.
All right. Thanks for calling, Jay. Appreciate that. So a bunch of things to chew on there, Mark.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that the message of, I mean, certainly Colin Kaepernick's message, which is, you know, to protest police brutality against African Americans, it has been largely lost, largely because so many people either have distorted it, and or other players have different things that they were protesting for or are protesting for. So I do think you do sort of, after a while, it gets lost in this larger maw of dissent, and people take it as disrespect for men and women in the military, of the flag, and so forth, which the people who are protesting will say that it's not meant as. So, look, this is he's also a classic case of a message that does get distorted very easily. But I also think that it's kind of disingenuous and just flat out wrong to think that he doesn't deserve to be on an NFL roster, especially if you look at some of the first week stats and some of the quarterbacks and some of these teams. He has a collusion case against the league right now. It's going forward. The league thought it was just going to go away, but an arbitrator a couple of weeks ago decided that he's going to hear the case, and we're going to hear more, and it's going to put a lot of NFL owners in a pretty uncomfortable position to have to testify. So it's certainly a nuisance to the league, but I also think it's becoming bigger and bigger every day. And then you have entities like Nike coming in and sort of filling the void of leadership that the league itself is not exercising.
Let's talk about the collusion thing, though, because it doesn't seem like it would need to be collusion when you've got owners who are generally allergic to controversy of that kind. And of course, right. Colin Kaepernick made himself the biggest allergen in the NFL.
Right. No, it's true. I mean, they would argue, I assume, that why should we invite all of this baggage onto our franchise and all of this distraction onto our team for the sake of having a possibly still effective backup quarterback on our roster? I mean, the zero sum or the cost benefit analysis, it's definitely a jump ball. I mean, the first objective of NFL teams or NFL owners tends not to be charity. It's like, all right, let's use one of our roster spots to sort of placate thoughts that, you know, let's do everyone a solid and just sort of like put him on our roster. I mean, no one's driven like that, and no one really wants the hassle, and I guess it is their right as a private business. But at the same time, you know, if there is collusion, I mean, there's a legal case to be made against it, and that's, you know, remains to be seen what the judges decide. But, look, he has made himself a difficult hire just for a lot of, you know, very real politic reasons. And, I don't know what the legalities around that are, but it's certainly true.
So let's talk about the development, though, with Nike and the ad campaign that came out just a couple of weeks ago, just the week before the NFL got started, and obviously long right. before you put this book to bed. I mean, what did you were you surprised to see it in the first place?
Yeah, no, I had no idea. I mean, I didn't even know that he had a deal with Nike, and all of a sudden we learned that they've been paying him all along, and now he's the face of this new campaign. I think that, like I said before, I mean, there is this vacuum of leadership from within the NFL. I mean, they're not making a policy. No one really knows where the league stands. And in the absence of that, you have plays, you know, things like Colin Kaepernick and Nike and the President of the United States just sort of jumping into the void and filling it with their message, whatever it is and whatever side it's on. So I think, you know, Nike probably made a determination that their brand is about boldness. And they also probably made the determination that the older, whiter demographic that is going to be most likely to be offended by their move is probably not like one of their core customers anyway. I mean, I think the people who would applaud them for this tend to be younger, tend to be probably more wealthy and more better educated and probably a much more coveted advertising demographic. So I think a lot went into it. I think Nike's like any other big corporation. There are very big bottom line considerations here, but it certainly adds a new dimension to this debate and this whole issue.
It's been interesting to watch the reaction unfold because, of course, we are based on the opposite end of the same state where Nike is headquartered. And I was reading a letter to the editor of the Oregonian over the weekend from somebody who said, "I'm going to invest in Nike for the first time because of this."
Yeah, you hear a lot of that, and then you see all these people burning their Nike socks on YouTube and stuff. So, I mean, I don't know how that's all going to shake down, but I do think that like I said before, I think there's a lot that goes into these decisions, and it's not just virtue.
Yeah, that is true. It's always a lot about money, and then brings us back to the owners again. And you spent some time with Jerry Jones, the Dallas Cowboys owner. He is really clear on who owns the NFL, isn't he?
Him or the owners. No. He's not wrong. I mean, look, this is a bizarre kind of setup where you have these 32 really, really rich, mostly, entirely white except for one owner, almost entirely male. And the average age has got to be like around 70 or so, who just own this thing. And it's a very sort of a plantation mentality. I mean, and that's, I think, something that's been true for a long time. But, for some reason, like, the NFL owners is like it's a protected class, more so than owners in other sports. Like we have to see the cutaways of them in their boxes after
every game. Yeah,
every game. It's a bizarre. It's a bizarre thing. It's like it's part of the broadcast contracts or something. But the first thing you learn when you go to work at the NFL is that owners are to be referred to as Mr. So and So. I mean, you refer to them by their first names or by a nickname at your peril.
Wow.
If you ever go to work for the NFL, remember that.
Yeah, okay. If a franchise comes to Southern Oregon, I'll be all set.
Correct.
When Jerry Jones, this is an interesting sideline, the personal story about Jerry Jones offering you a shot of whiskey before. What did he mean by a shot of whiskey?
What he meant by a shot of whiskey, well, first of all, it was 1 o'clock in the afternoon. We were on the Dallas Cowboys bus, which is not for the faint of heart or liver, which I learned the hard way. But he offered me a shot of whiskey, and by shot he meant, or a shot of scotch, and by shot he meant a 24-ounce Dallas Cowboys souvenir cup filled with ice and Johnny Walker Blue, which was refilled 3 times in the course of what became a deteriorating 4 or 5 hour interview. Luckily, my tape recorder worked perfectly throughout, even if I didn't at the end of that afternoon. And he, on the other hand, is just like a heavyweight scotch drinker and apparently left the bus and went into the clubhouse of the golf course we were at and ordered up beers and cigars. So, I don't know. Jerry Jones I've never had an interview like that in my life, and I hope I don't again, but it was certainly illuminating, and he's certainly entertaining.
He's been one of the guys who's been most outspoken about the dealing during the anthem thing. But it gets us back to a major political versus economics question, which is we got a league that is owned generally by conservative Republicans, but it ended up with a revenue-sharing scheme that is really rather socialist in its design.
Sure. Absolutely. No, I mean, the NFL owners entered into an agreement, several decades ago that they would share all, broadcast revenue, share all national revenue, basically. And so, yes, it is a form of socialism or I guess a form of billionaire socialism, but it does benefit everyone. And there is some resentments about, how come the Chicago Bears, given the size of their market, don't actually bring in more revenue for the league? They keep score of franchise revenues and franchise worth, just like they do keep score, on the field. But, Jerry Jones is sort of king in that area. I mean, the Dallas Cowboys are the most valuable franchise in the NFL. They have the nicest stadium. Jerry Jones is in the Hall of Fame. They're all sort of eyeing each other. I mean, is Stephen Tisch, the owner or the co-owner of the New York Giants said it's junior high school for billionaires, and that's very much what it is.
But that revenue sharing scheme is what makes it possible for a place like the Green Bay Packers, which is the smallest market in the entire NFL by a long shot, to be able to win the Super Bowl.
Yeah, and I think that the Green Bay Packers are just a jewel of the NFL. I mean, Lambeau Field is like probably the greatest stadium I think we have, and I loved going there. It was one of the great joys of my reporting here, even though it was freezing. It was like 10 degrees below zero or something. But it's a very, it does sort of allow for those sort of little pockets of Americana to become these, you know, great and enduring American stories and community stories. And I think it's great for football. I mean, I'm sure there are people within the NFL that would love to put the public shares of the Green Bay Packers up for sale and find a new really, really, really wealthy billionaire who can make everyone even richer. But I think, look, it's something in the NFL that works, and I hope it works forever.
So, Mark, just time enough for another question. We're talking about the NFL in dangerous times. The subtitle of the book, The Sense That the Chandelier Might Be About to Come Down. Is anybody really doing anything to guard against the chandelier coming down?
Well, not really, because they just keep printing money. I mean, for as long as, broadcast networks keep, giving them billions of dollars, people want to spend billions of dollars on new franchises and everyone's getting rich, and, many of them are old to begin with, there's not a lot of impetus to do anything outside the status quo. And that includes hiring a new commissioner who might be better equipped to see around corners. So in the meantime, we'll all just watch football until one day it'll be a different sport.
Well, Mark Leibovich is our guest on The Exchange, chief national correspondent for the New York Times Magazine, the author of Big Game, The NFL in Dangerous Times. Thanks so much for joining us, Mark.
Thanks for having me on. I enjoyed it.